You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
In today's episode, Jesus has just been baptized in the Jordan and tempted in the desert. Today's passage is Luke's version of what happens next. Jesus heads back to his mom's sofa for a break, but wait, there's more. Mark and Matthew keep it pretty simple. They just say, he taught in the synagogue. But leave it to Luke to make it much longer and more elaborate. A couple of things to keep in mind as you visualize the setting of the story. First, I can't overemphasize how tiny and insignificant a village Nazareth was. Maybe a couple of dozen families of dirt-poor subsistence farmers or peasants. Sadly, Luke didn't know this. He conjures up a separate building that he called a synagogue, which was extremely unlikely to have existed. Synagogue just means gathering. So if this episode actually took place, it would have been in a small courtyard or town square. Second, scholars disagree as to whether Jesus could read or write. Mark and Matthew have Jesus simply teaching in the synagogue, no reading. But leave it to the academic Luke to assume that Jesus was a scholar who could read classic Hebrew, which was unlikely for someone of Jesus' upbringing. Finally, Luke gives himself away as A, not being Jewish, and B, being willing to manipulate the facts in having Jesus read stuff from Isaiah that's not really there. That's right. Luke edits Hebrew scripture to his advantage. Since healing the blind is such an important element of Luke's Jesus, Luke has Jesus read that Isaiah proclaims healing the blind as one of the characteristics of the anointed one. It's convenient for Luke's agenda, but it's not actually in Isaiah. After Jesus reads from the scroll, he takes his seat and announces that Isaiah's prophetic words are fulfilled in his own person. Now, while at first people are intrigued by the possibility, when they actually think about the implications, they get pretty worked up and proceed to run him out of town, which is what happens right after our passage.
Our words of wisdom are from Luke, chapter 4, verses 16 through 20, the voice version. Jesus eventually came to his hometown, Nazareth, and did there what he had done elsewhere in Galilee, entered the synagogue and stood up to read from the Hebrew scriptures. The synagogue attendant gave him the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and Jesus unrolled it to the place where Isaiah had written these words.
The Spirit of the Lord, the Eternal One, is on me. Why? Because the Eternal designated me to be his representative to the poor, to preach good news to them. He sent me to tell those who are held captive that they can now be set free, and to tell the blind that they can now see. He sent me to liberate those held down by oppression. In short, the Spirit is upon me to proclaim that now is the time. This is the Jubilee season of the Eternal One's grace.
Jesus rolled up the scroll and returned it to the synagogue attendant. Then he sat down, as a teacher would do, and all in the synagogue focused their attention on Jesus, waiting for him to speak.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
10 years ago or so, Jeff Proctor Murphy and I were preaching on this same topic of Ubuntu. On a subsequent Sunday, one of Jeff's musicians came rushing up to him and said, "You won't believe it, but on the way here, I saw a car with the license plate Ubuntu. It was spelled differently, but it was Ubuntu. Can you believe it?" Jeff asked, "Was it a Prius?" "Yeah." "Was it red?" "Yeah." That was David. and here's my license plate. Besides the Golden Rule license plate making me feel really bad when I cut someone off in traffic, the Ubuntu message gets me stopped in parking lots all the time. I've even had job offers on the spot. People call out to me, "Hey, you write code?" No. "Well, why do you have Ubuntu on your license plate?" So this is when I get to explain to some unsuspecting software engineer that the open source Linux software they know as Ubuntu was funded by a South African entrepreneur. And since Ubuntu is a revolutionary idea that helped defeat apartheid, what better name for open source software, which is developed in public collaborative forums, than "I am because we are"? You should see their faces when they realize they've just struck up a conversation, not with a fellow programmer, but with a religious fanatic, as they fumble with their keys and start to back away as quickly as possible. It always strikes me that none of them had been curious enough about the strange name of the operating system they love to have gone investigating where its name came from. Ubuntu! I am because we are. Over the last couple of weeks, we've talked about the principle of Ubuntu and how it offers an alternative to the rugged individualism of the West. It celebrates interconnectedness, collaboration, equality, interdependence. Some might try and explain it as some kind of networking or a new communication tool, but it's more about living into a way of being that runs counter to our basic human nature of tribalism and security at all costs. In fact, it's important to note that not everyone in Africa just naturally practices Ubuntu. Another great proponent of Ubuntu, Dr. Michael Battle, points out that the spirit of Ubuntu has yet to influence what he calls some of Africa's tragic heritage. He writes, "Africans need to overcome the traditional belief that heaven is reserved for men and embrace the dignity and worth of women as equals. Africa needs to educate its people out of a worldview that depends on magic for change, an ignorance that has made the AIDS crisis even more tragic. And it needs to stop oppressing minorities, be they racial or homosexual or religious. Ubuntu is a work in progress. And because the forces working against it are so primal to the human condition, it has to be constantly shored up and promoted in order to get any traction. It's important to note that while the ancient principle of Ubuntu helped galvanize people in crippling the idea of apartheid, in the final analysis, it wasn't dreams of rainbows and unicorns that finally broke apartheid's grip. What really got the South African government's attention was global economic divestment, cold, hard cash on the nail. As we talked about last week, Ubuntu is the end we have in mind. And in the meantime, real-world pressures and strategies need to be brought to bear in convincing the powers that be that it is to everyone's advantage to leave behind the primitive tribalism and fear of the other and mature as a species. In our passage today, Jesus quotes Luke's version of the prophet Isaiah to people who were oppressed and struggling. He speaks to peasants, people who are huddled in fear and uncertainty, intimidated by the cosmic forces jerking them around, people who are the discarded, broken pieces of empire. And what does Jesus do? He reminds them of their common lot. He promises good news to the poor, release to the captives, sight for the blind, freedom to the oppressed. He simultaneously expands their universe, urging them to see beyond their own problems, and draws people close, saying, we're all in this together. The poor, the oppressed, the blind. Jesus shows them the power that is at the heart of Ubuntu. I am because we are. Look, you say, that sounds all well and good, but just try to suggest it to people as a practical option, right? Yeah, it didn't even go well for Jesus. After suggesting that he was essentially going to turn the world upside down, the people in his own village felt so threatened that they tried to throw him off a cliff. Ubuntu goes counter to most people's comfort zones. It not only says that we are intricately, mysteriously, unavoidably interconnected with one another, but with all of creation too. If you're going along thinking you're going to avoid the effects of climate change because you're somehow not a part of its cause or the solution, you're in for a big surprise. Bishop Tutu said, as scientists understand more and more about the interdependence not only of living things, but of rocks, rivers, the whole of the universe, I am left in awe that I too am a part of this tremendous miracle. Not only am I a part of this pulsating network, but I am an indispensable part. Each of us an indispensable part of the universe. And the sooner we embrace the reality that how we live and what we value has impact on the world at large, the better it will be for all of our futures. But where to start? Most of us can't fathom wrapping our arms around the whole world. Our next-door neighbor is irritating enough. Then take that irritation as an opportunity. Khalil Gibran said, I have learned silence from the talkative, toleration from the intolerant, and kindness from the unkind. Every encounter is an opportunity to learn what it's going to take for you to be a part of the solution. Be like Jesus. Look around. Look for those who are left out, hated, or voiceless. Reach out to them. Be there for them. Last week, I was talking with a friend who lives in another state, who was feeling sad about the hostage taking in the Houston synagogue. He said, wow, I'll bet this is a tough time for rabbis dealing with not only their own fear, but the concerns of their congregations, especially in places like my town where it's so predominantly fundamentalist Christian. It must be lonely. I asked him, do you have a local synagogue? Oh, yeah. Well, have you called the rabbi? Who, me? No. Why not? I'm not Jewish. Who am I in the larger scheme of things? Well, you're a fellow human being concerned for a neighbor. Silence. Then he said, you know what? I'm going to call the synagogue. And even if I don't get the rabbi, I'll just leave a short message of support. That's it, isn't it? Small gestures that say to one another, I'm with you. Do it enough, and pretty soon, people will start to get the sense that they're not alone. The end we have in mind is Ubuntu. If one of us is left out or threatened or suffering, the picture's incomplete. Creation is not whole.
Sometimes when I hear the sounds of children playing, my mind wanders back to my time in Africa. I remember there was this once I was playing with a group of children, and I proposed a rather stupid game. I had placed a basket of strawberries under a tree, and I told the children that the first one to find it could keep them all to themselves. But what the kids did in response changed me forever. Instead of running off one by one to find the basket, they held each other's hands and ran together. And when they found the basket, they all shared the fruit. When I asked them why they did that, they told me, "Ubuntu, how can one of us be happy if all the other ones are sad?"
How can one of us be happy if all the other ones are sad? You may not know the name Emma Lazarus, but you know her words. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Emma wrote these words as part of a poem used to raise money for the construction of the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. As a Jew, Emma was an activist for Jewish and immigrant causes and, in her own way, promoted the spirit of Ubuntu. In fact, in the 1880s, she wrote, "Until we are all free, none of us are free." 80 years later, Martin Luther King Jr. paraphrased the sentiment with, "No one is free until we are all free," which takes us to our stream of thought that Richard and Donna sang for us earlier. None of us are free if one of us is chained. How can one of us be happy if all the other ones are sad? I am because we are. However you say it, I think the idea of Ubuntu is where Jesus would have us set our sights. But it's slow. It's almost imperceptible. When we practice Ubuntu, we need to be okay with knowing that we may never live to see the fruits of our labor, but are still convinced that the future depends on doing what we can here and now to make "I am because we are" real in the world. You know, I've been told that it takes 5 years for the seed of a bamboo tree to show any growth above ground. But after 5 years of preparation, putting down roots and spreading out underground, it can grow to 90 feet in 6 weeks. And if you've ever tried to get rid of bamboo, you know that's virtually impossible. So it may appear to the casual observer that nothing is actually happening, but the groundwork for real growth takes place in the unseen depths of hearts and minds. To close, let me share a Marge Piercy reflection I learned from Cantor Shira at Beth Hagivot. It lays out some practical strategies for those of us who, in our own small ways, are working toward making Ubuntu come alive in the world. Connections are made slowly. Sometimes they grow underground. You cannot tell always by looking what is happening. More than half the tree is spread out in the soil under your feet. Penetrate quietly as the earthworm that blows no trumpet. Fight persistently as the creeper that brings down the tree. Spread like the squash plant that overruns the garden. Weave real connections. Create real nodes. Keep tangling and interweaving and taking more in. A thicket and bramble wilderness to the outside, but to us, interconnected with rabbit runs and burrows and layers. Reach out. Keep reaching out. Keep bringing in, for every gardener knows that after the digging, after the planting, after the long season of tending and growth, the harvest comes. Interconnectedness, collaboration, cooperation, compassion, a way of being that fosters humility in oneself and a profound respect for the other. That's Ubuntu. And it's no mystery how it happens. Quietly, among the broken, the discarded, the rejected. Bringing good news to the poor, release to the captives, sight for the blind, freedom to the oppressed. So as long as it takes, may the spirit of Ubuntu continue to draw us out of ourselves and towards creating the future we all know is possible. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputtlovefirst.org.